Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, JCWI, Caitlin Boswell said, "The racism of the UK's immigration system couldn't be more clear, with this government drawing policies affecting people seeking safety along stark racial lines. At the same time, ministers are using unashamedly inflammatory and far-right language, whipping up hatred towards black and brown migrants." In the meantime, RT noted, the British government has been accused of operating an unashamedly racist refugee system by denying safe and legal passage to people escaping conflict in Sudan, while providing those options for those fleeing Ukraine, immigration experts told The Guardian. The blatant refusal to provide a level of sanctuary and safety for Sudanese refugees in comparison to white Ukrainians has firmly exposed the unashamedly racist thinking at the heart of immigration legislation. Fitzi Qureshi, chief executive of the Migrants' Rights Network, told the British outlet Guardian recently. She accused the Home Office of Britain of having created a segregated refugee system. UK Foreign Secretary James Cleverly said London had coordinated the longest and largest evacuation of any Western country after the final flight from Port Sudan departed on May 3rd. More than 2,450 people were reportedly evacuated on 30 flights, the majority of whom were British nationals and their dependents. The UK also announced it would provide an initial £5 million, $6.3 million of life-saving aid to help meet the urgent needs of those fleeing the violence. However, The Guardian noted that no safe and legal routes have been made available to help Sudanese refugees flee, and there is no sign of any new scheme to deal with the fallout of the conflict. Meanwhile, the report said nearly 300,000 visas had been issued to Ukrainian refugees, including 193,900 under Home Sponsorship Scheme, which began in March 2022, and 94,900 for a family program that allows them to reunite with family members already living in the UK. Caitlin Boswell, Policy and Advocacy Manager for the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, told The Guardian that the government develops policies affecting those seeking safety along stark racial lines. Raga Ahmad of the Sudanese Community and Information Centre in London also claimed that people from his country are treated differently to Ukrainians, adding that color and race should not matter when there is a crisis. In response to the allegations, a UK government spokesperson said it was wrong to compare and set vulnerable groups against each other, and insisted that preventing a humanitarian crisis in Sudan was a priority. Last month, the Refugee Council said the UK Home Office had the power to help more, but had failed to do so. It had significant discretion it can use to grant visas, particularly in response to exceptional circumstances, but has decided not to, said the council's chief executive, Enver Solomon. He added that there was a need to prioritize safe routes for refugees in the same way that was done for Ukrainians last year. We'll be right back.
everything about football. I don't think we know Jonas Salk. The name doesn't really ring a bell. Jonas Salk is a person who developed polio vaccine for everyone free of charge. All of us are indebted to him, but we just don't know him. On the other hand, there are many people who may not know Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Or, for example, we don't know the name of the president of Gabon. Actually, most of us don't know anything about Gabon, but we know Aubameyang, the Gabonese football player. This is a rule. Football players are the most famous people. People, even in far-fetched places in the world, love football, and they follow everything about football. You only need to be in the first layer of football. Then everyone in the world will fix their eyes on you, and everyone in the world will know you. Football is the key to fame. Football is the key to popularity. Fame and popularity will bring power and wealth. This is what subconsciously draws politicians to football.
The 45-year-old is the third richest person in the UK with an estimated fortune of over £10 billion. He bought Chelsea Football Club in 2003 and has the ear of the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who got extremely rich after the collapse of the Soviet Union and about the power struggles in modern Russia.
The name of many politicians in the world are so tightly intertwined with football that people in the world can hardly remember their political designation. For example, not many people remember Roman Abramovich, the owner of the Chelsea club, was once a member of the Russian parliament, the Duma, or was a governor of a district in Russia. Many people in the world know Silvio Berlusconi, not a powerful former Italian prime minister, but as the owner of AC Milan club. Many people don't care the current owner of the Manchester City club is the vice president of the cabinet of minister of the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, and this is not the entire story. Evo Morales, the former president of Bolivia, played football in friendly and local matches in front of thousands of his supporters and those who voted for him.
Sadi is sort of the black sheep of the Gaddafi family. He tried to enter professional football or soccer in Italy. He played one game for Perugia, but then failed a drug test.
Sadi, Gaddafi's third son, left no stone unturned so he could play in Calcio. And the legendary Fidel Castro loved to spend time with Maradona, a world-class legend of football. Many politicians are directly engaged in the game of football. The story doesn't end here. Political parties and groups love to use the popularity of great football players to achieve power. For example, Kaká Khaled's AC Milan's robust defense was elected as the mayor of Tbilisi. Before that, George Weah, the legendary striker of Milan, became the president of Liberia. Brazil's Romário became a member of parliament in his country. Before that, Hakan Şükür, the renowned Turkish forward, was voted to become a member of parliament. In 2008, when Roman Pavlyuchenko was scoring a goal against Edwin van der Sar like this, he had been voted as a member of the Duma in Russia. Sometimes it's the football players themselves who use people to guarantee that their people's political goals will be fulfilled. For example, Dr. Socrates, with his memorable goals against Russia or Italy, he was a genius who would sometimes wear headbands with political slogans on them. He would also wear shirts with political slogans and would fight the military dictatorship in Brazil like a revolutionary. Or Lillian Thuram, who made interviews in support of immigrants and black people and those who live in shanty towns in France. He had vitriolic words for then French president.
When you're the president of the Republic of France, you can make speeches like Mr. Sarkozy did in Dakar, for example, when he explained that black people had never made a mark on history. It was a racist speech.
Or Didier Drogba, who used his popularity to help stop the civil war in the Ivory Coast. Football and politics are twins. When no politician could ignore a weapon named football, and when insignificant clubs and less famous players can have remarkable political roles and influence, it's only natural that the World Cup turns into a major opportunity for political campaigns. Millions of people are glued to the games for a month. The headlines of all media are about this big event. All cameras in the world are directed towards the World Cup. It's the best opportunity to be seen, to be known, to become popular, and to gain power and influence. That's why most of the great politicians, one way or another, pretend that they're involved with the World Cup. That's why politicians try to direct the World Cup.
The 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
The game of the politicians for the World Cup starts from the time of selecting the host. They meet FIFA officials. They discuss with other heads of states. They deliver speeches and advertise. They spend their money, fame, and credit. Even in some cases, they might spend illegal money to be chosen as the host. Being chosen as a host means economic boosts, increase in popularity, and to a great deal, guaranteeing the political future. It's natural that people in a country are satisfied with the politicians who take the most important event to their country. But what if they're not the host?
Landon, what do we got? You got a jersey. Hope you guys caught that. That doesn't happen very often. Okay, and what do we got here? That's good.
Well, in that case, they meet the players and the national team coach as a first stage. Almost all presidents and prime ministers take a sneak peek at the national team preparations before they go for the competitions. They take as many pictures as they can and record videos with famous players and announce their support for the representatives of their country to the world. And now, they have to show themselves in the World Cup. They enter the stadium and sit right next to each other in the VIP stands and show themselves so worried or happy so everyone knows that there is nothing more important for them than their national team. If they can't take part in person, they record a video message.
Man, I just wanted to call and say you guys did us proud.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys captured the hearts and imaginations of the whole country. It's unbelievable.
Well, we heard you were watching, and we know how big a supporter you are, so hopefully we made you proud. It was our honor, as it always is, to represent our country.
All right, appreciate you guys. Safe travels back.
Thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Sometimes they even make controversial interviews about the incidents during the World Cup. For example, after Suarez was dismissed and Uruguay was defeated by Colombia, then-President Jose Mujica took part in the ceremony to commemorate the Uruguayan football star and in an interview branded FIFA officials as a bunch of sons of who defeated his country's team on purpose. It's true, an all-out political show takes place on the sidelines of the World Cup. That's why politicians get extremely happy over their team's ascent to the World Cup. The World Cup gives them plenty of opportunities so they can promote their status or stabilize it, or at least it gives them an opportunity to show themselves to the world.
And the break is on Amiri. Osmoun is sure on goal. Here he can put it round ahead. It's Osmoun! Suspended save into Hamdash.
The first achievement is getting closer to the citizens. Ordinary people are crazy about football. They love their national team. Victory, pride, and their flag is more important than anything else for them. When the president of a country watches people's favorite team just like them, it can mean that he's part of the people. He has the same interests and obsessions, and he will do anything so their favorite team, namely the favorite team of his fellow citizens, will win. This public belief is a major point in the minds of voters in the next elections and in the mind of the people in other countries who consider it as a symbol of a nation. Besides all of this, participation of a country in the World Cup and its success during the games will change everything in that country. Public joy and spirit, unity among the people, and even satisfaction with the standard of living. Politicians love the World Cup. They use this opportunity to achieve their goals, and this is one of the reasons of the theory that the World Cup is a political phenomenon. Yes, it's one of the reasons.
It's Jordan Shaqiri now for Switzerland. Can he win it? Shaqiri scores! What a turnaround from Switzerland! One goal down at the break. They have now scored twice in this second half.
The other reason is politics has always imposed itself on the World Cup throughout history. The competitions have always been a symbolic scene for conflicting political forces. It's a rich political history. The 1934 World Cup was held in Italy. Mussolini, the fascist leader of Italy at the time, would go to the stadium, becoming the champion was so important for Mussolini that he did whatever it took to achieve that. He even invited the referee who would officiate the Italy-Austria match to a private party on the eve of the game. The flamboyant closing ceremony of that edition of the World Cup was held in a completely nationalistic atmosphere. The political tinge was obvious in the next World Cup as well. When the national anthem of Italy was being played, the Italian players hailed like fascists as a military unit. On the other hand, the German team was a combination of German and Austrian players, 7 German players and 4 Austrian players, because the same year, Hitler had managed to annex Austria to German territory. That year, Italy became the champion for a second time. Mussolini achieved everything he wanted from football, nationalistic passion, joy, pride, public excitement, and unity. Later on, in the 1954 World Cup, Bern was a realm of muscle flexing for Germans. Only 9 years after a war that ruined the country, the Germans showcased their indefatigable and fighting spirit. In the strangest final match in history, they defeated Hungary in a dreamlike comeback and revived their national pride that had been trampled upon. Now, the defeated Germany had something to take pride in, a symbol of the uprising of a country that had lost everything it had. In the following World Cups, football turned into a symbol of rivalry between the East and West. The Eastern Bloc countries try to flaunt the orderly structure and teamwork in their societies within their teams as well. For them, football was a battle. It was an arena to prove that their philosophical and political beliefs were correct. In the 1958 World Cup, the Soviet Union defeated Britain, and North Korea became a phenomenon in 1966 and defeated powerful Italy 1-0. Later on, in the playoff match in 1974, the Soviet Union had to play against Chile. The political officials of the Communist Party decided not to play in Chile as a protest. Pinochet, the Western-backed dictator, had just orchestrated a coup, and the Santiago Stadium had turned into the biggest political prison in the world. FIFA announced the result 3-0 in favor of Chile. As ordered by General Pinochet, the Chilean players were in the field and were attacking the Soviets' empty goal. Chile took part in the 1974 World Cup. The confrontation between the East and West reached its climax when the two swaths of the post-war Germany, namely the East and the West, played against each other. Afterwards, politicians came up with the idea of changing the results. There are strange but unconfirmed reports about match fixing in the 1978 World Cup in Argentina. General Jorge Videla, the Argentine dictator back then, and Morales Peros, the Peruvian president, they say the Argentine government forcibly disappeared some of the Peruvian dissidents exactly the way it would deal with its own dissidents. In return, Peru received 6 goals in a suspicious match and paved the path for Argentina to become champion. The dictator back then needed it to calm the public. Four years later, in the 1982 World Cup, fixing the outcome by political authorities did not need any conspiracy. Kuwait received the 4th goal from France, a Kuwaiti official got into the field and kicked a fuss and threatened that he'd get his team off the field. The fuss yielded a result. The referee disallowed the goal and the raging politician went back to the stands.
The World Cup is beloved across our planet, because it offers a chance for people from around the world to be judged not by the place they grew up, the color of their skin, or the way they choose to worship, but by their spirit, skill, and strength.
And finally, one of the most politically charged games in the history of the World Cup, the match between Iran and the U.S.
As we cheer today's game between American and Iranian athletes, I hope it can be another step toward ending the estrangement between our nations.
Let's not forget that the World Cup is not just a sports event. It's part of a political process for politicians to gain power and popularity. Let's not forget that only with a little attention, we could see that the World Cup, with all of the issues that surround it, is a tool in the hands of different governments to push their goals forward. Let's not forget that every minor incident in the World Cup might affect the political fate of millions of people. And the exciting and attractive games of the World Cup can be more than a simple football match. For example, it might be a political battlefield for two countries or two political schools. Let's remember that political powers affect the World Cup, and the World Cup affects political powers. This time, we can view it a little deeper. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The United Nations Food Agency's World Price Index rose in April for the first time in a year. The Food and Agriculture Organization's Price Index, FAO, which tracks the most globally traded food commodities, averaged 127.2 points last month against 126.5 for March, the agency said recently. The March reading was originally given as 126.9. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more, please. Anadolu News Agency reported global food prices increased in April for the first time in a year, led by higher prices of sugar, meat and rice. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, said recently. The FAO Food Price Index, a trade weight index that tracks international market prices of five major food commodity groups, averaged 127.2 points, up 0.6% from March, but down 19.7% from a year ago. The sugar price index jumped 17.6% month on month, reaching its highest level since October 2011, and the index for meat increased 1.3%. The FAO cereal price index, on the other hand, dipped 1.7% from March. The increase in rice prices is extremely worrisome, and it is essential that the Black Sea Initiative is renewed to avoid any other spikes in wheat and maize, said Maximo Torero, the chief economist at FAO. The vegetable oil price index decreased by 1.3% in the month, seeing its fifth consecutive monthly decline. The dairy price index slipped 1.7% during the same period. In the meantime, RT reported the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations reported that global food prices grew in April for the first time in a year. The price index, which tracks the most globally traded food commodities, averaged 127.2 points last month. The slight rebound in the FFPI, that is FAO Food Price Index, in April was led by a steep increase in the sugar price index, along with an upturn in the meat price index, while the cereals, dairy and vegetable oil price indices continue to drop, the FAO said. According to the report, the sugar price index soared 17.6% from March, hitting its highest level since October 2011, the rise was reportedly linked to concerns over tighter supplies, following downward revisions to production forecasts for India and China, along with lower than expected output in Thailand and the European Union. The outlet noted the meat price index was up 1.3% from March, while dairy prices fell 1.7%. Vegetable oil prices were also down 1.3%, marking the fifth consecutive monthly decline. The cereal price index dropped 1.7% with a decline in world prices of all major grains, outweighing an increase in rice prices. FAO chief economist said the increase in rice prices is extremely worrisome, and it is essential that the Black Sea Initiative is renewed to avoid any other spikes in the wheat and maize. The FAO report indicated that international wheat prices declined by 2.3% in April to their lowest level since July 2021, principally driven by large exportable availabilities in Russia and Australia. According to the UN body, favorable crop conditions in Europe, along with an agreement at the end of April allowing Ukrainian grains to transit through European Union countries that had imposed import restrictions earlier in the month, also contributed to the overall softer tone in markets. Meanwhile, Torero projected that as global economies recover from significant slowdowns, demand will increase, exerting upward pressure on food prices around the world.
Hidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene, because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases. and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota included cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Brothomeo Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwanda, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim or the hands of the victim back to the force public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against the Congolese people for any small thing. You could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. So many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery. The oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands and unsafe mines, and it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich natural resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tet is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Rain. You think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese?
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced a population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face. And he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments, which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers, so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played: divide and rule, proxy governments, which are created by the foreign powers, and thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge, because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of this suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lualua, and Romelu Lukaku. They're top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, No entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance? The Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter. I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by Germany.